For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. So for new people, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here, and I'm very happy to have giving a talk tonight, Brian Taylor, who's a regular practitioner here for a little while, and also is the Reverend Brian Taylor. He's an Episcopal minister, but he's practiced also before here with Jogo Beck, a well-known American Zen teacher. Brian's going to talk about contemplative practices in Christianity and related to Zen, and I think it's an important topic for all of us. I've done a lot of Buddhist-Christian dialogue myself, but all of us as Westerners or Americans doing Buddhism have this dialogue context of coming from a Judeo-Christian culture. So anyway, thank you very much, Brian, for coming and giving this talk.
Well, thank you, Taigen, for this opportunity. I really appreciate it. I thought I'd begin by giving a little bit of context in terms of how I came to be sitting here. I grew up in the Episcopal Church, but wasn't terribly involved in it. I think the only thing that really spoke to me was the formal liturgy and the music. When I became old enough to say no to my mother, I stopped going. And that was about the same time that the counterculture in the San Francisco Bay Area where I was living was really cranked up. And that, for me, became a place of community and also spirituality, as it was for many people in those times in the late 1960s. The music, the hitchhiking around with friends, and for me, some of the, looking back on them, what I would call perhaps meditative experiences, some of which were chemically induced and some were not. But at any rate, music continued to be a path for me. And then at the age of about 25, I had a real conversion experience where I decided that I had a series of crises, as often bring these things on. And I remember lying in bed thinking about myself as an old man who is dying and asking myself, what did you want to live for? And the answer was immediate, I want to live for God. And I didn't know really what that meant, but within a year I was in seminary, Episcopal Seminary in Berkeley, which is part of the same graduate theological union that Taigen got his doctorate at and still teaches through. And I think that the church accepted me somewhat, a little skeptically, given my background. I wasn't a very churchy applicant, but nevertheless, I made it through. I made it through with fear and trembling, however, because I knew that there was always the potential of becoming a company man and, in a sense, losing my soul in the process. And I knew I would never completely fit in. And I didn't, and yet I did. So I became the rector, senior pastor of a church that eventually became quite large in Albuquerque. And I ended up being there for 30 years. And I think what I did to not lose my soul and hopefully do some good at the same time was to focus everything around spirituality. Recognizing that that the religious forms, my understanding was always that religious forms are like a map to a territory, and the map is not the territory, and there are many different maps that often lead to the same kind of territory, and that it was just a form and not to be taken too seriously. So I used that form and focused on spirituality, retreats. My interest was the monastic life, although I was married and had two kids, but still the monastic sensibility and practices, some of them. People like Thomas Merton I was very interested in, and I ended up studying a lot and writing and publishing some books and leading retreats and that sort of thing. So I was able to bring this congregation into this work of seeking and not just playing church together. 24 years ago, which was in the middle of this time, or actually towards the beginning of it, I came across Joko Beck and went for 7 years to sessions there in San Diego twice a year, and there were the week-long variety. And she was very encouraging to me in terms of helping me practice Zazen in a way that I could see it in harmony with contemplative prayer, which I was already doing. So that built in the congregation. I ended up having a contemplative center eventually with weekly groups of sitting, contemplative prayer, Zazen, and we read various sources and we had speakers come in, workshops and retreats, weekend retreats and things. And the Zen was really sort of, after those 7 years of practice with Joko, was sort of in the background, but it was always there for me. And I've always continued to read and do contemplative prayer. 3 years ago, I started approaching retirement and really turned again towards Zen as my main focus during my last year at the church and in the 2 years since then. And it has become the main thing for me. And I'm terribly grateful for this Sangha and for Taigen and for all of you and the support you've given me over the last 16 months being here. So I'm a beginner again, and this is my focus. I don't identify with being a Christian or being a Buddhist. Those labels to me are not terribly helpful. As a friend of mine says, I'm a verb, not a noun, and I like that. I'm just a human being doing the best I can to awaken like everybody else. So I wanted to talk about a few things that are ways in which I've found Zen very helpful to me in bringing a kind of refreshing spirit to some of the things that I've done for a long time with contemplative prayer and that I think the two traditions have in common. I'm not going to try to be comprehensive. That would take years. I'm not going to try to contrast the two traditions. There's a lot about Christianity and Buddhism that are very different. I'm not going to try to cover all the things that are similar. And I just speak for myself. And I look forward to... I have a lot to learn in the Buddhist tradition. And I look forward to correction and guidance and more clarity as time goes by. I also want to make it clear that I'm, as a contemplative Christian, even though I've been sort of in the mainstream of parish life, I don't speak for mainstream Christianity, and I can't. That's not where I am. I've always felt on the margins, and so don't feel as if you're getting my description of what Christianity is really all about. It's really, I'm trying to speak from the contemplative viewpoint, which has always been a minority voice in Christianity, but it's always been there. And it's always been a strong voice at the margins. So the first of these things that has really been helpful to me in this overlap is Zazen itself, contemplative prayer itself, the practice of silence and stillness beyond words and conceptions, giving myself to what Christian contemplatives call unknowing. One of the greatest sources for the contemplative experience is the cloud of unknowing from the 13th century, an English anonymous writer. And it's really just being in that unknowing where I discover, like you do, my attachments and my aversions, my habitual ways of thinking and planning and trying to control. And in Christian tradition, there's this term, this Greek word, kenosis. And kenosis really means self-emptying. And I that's part of what I believe happens, or what I experience in contemplative prayer as Zazen, is a sort of a self-emptying, that is an emptying of the conditioned self through exposure to the light. And in the Christian understanding of that, as self is emptied out, there is space then for the divine life to have room, to arise, to manifest. And this has a long tradition. In many ways, you know, St. Paul, the one who wrote the letters in the New Testament, is known for his kind of narrow-mindedness and rigidity and, you know, misogyny and all kinds of terrible things. He was a complex person, and part of his complexity was that he had had some kind of mystical experience and it never left him. And he talked about this kenosis and making room for something larger to arise in these things that he would talk about. He would say, just flat out, we have the mind of Christ. I mean, it sounds an awful lot like Buddha nature to me. And what he would say is, it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And I really believe that Paul had experienced something which I think of as a process of subtraction rather than addition. Many people approach meditation or any kind of spirituality as a adding up virtues and practices and skills and abilities so that you construct this spiritual self. And I believe what the contemplative path is, and I think what Zazen does too, is it's a process of subtraction. It's taking away those things that are extraneous or conditioned that make room for what is inherent to manifest. And Christians would call that God. And so the intention of a contemplative has classically been what is called union with God. There's a danger in that kind of term, that kind of thinking of dualism. And you hear a lot of people talking about being close to God or having God in them or seeking God as if God is a separate entity that one is then so close in relationship with that somehow they're fused. And for me, that kind of union never made any sense. I never could get it. And I believe that this whole idea of union with God can be a kind of dualism when it's seen as a relationship with this, whatever this reality is we call God. And I've been very helped in the Zen tradition with some of these paradoxical notions like being distinct but not separate. As people, as the natural world, Buddha nature, as distinct but not separate. Another term that's used sometimes is not two and not one. There is oneness and there is variety within that oneness. And that's really how I see this aim of union with God in the contemplative sense. And very recently, I was reading with a few of you Dogen's portions of his Shobo Genzo, and there was this remarkable little passage, really in a footnote, that said that, you know, typically in the Buddhist tradition of that time, it was said that all beings have Buddha nature as something that exists within them, or that they have the potential for Buddha nature. And Dogen turned that kind of on its head, as he often did apparently with terms, and said, not all beings have Buddha nature, but all being is Buddha nature. And that's a very different kind of union. It's not the union of two entities, but simply union. So in Zazen, the way in contemplative prayer, the way I experience that, in, you know, beyond ideas here, is in the silence, a kind of what I would describe using a metaphor as a sort of a contracting, like the brain is contracting around an imaginary self that is distinct and separate, and then noticing I'm doing that and expanding it open to the oneness that is individuality and God and the world and time and space, which we call suchness in its concreteness. And typically, I just do what you do in Zazen, I think, very similar. And if I pray, it is, in terms of words, it might be at the end of a period of Zazen. And I have ceased using any kind of salutation for this reason, like, oh God, please such and such, because it immediately sets up this dualistic relationship that I don't buy. And instead, I just say it. If it's a prayer about generosity, I just say, for generosity, remembering so-and-so's health problems, or whatever it is that's on my mind, I'll just say it, as we do here in the service sometimes. We just name things in that oneness. And my understanding of that in a contemplative sense, in a prayer sense, is that it is spoken and it is heard in this oneness, and there is response all at once. And so another area that I've found some real help with in terms of the Zen tradition is, believe it or not, around the word that we use in Christianity for that experience, which is God. In the Christian tradition, and actually in any religious tradition, I think including Buddhism, there is what Christians have called two different ways of looking at things. Not that these are comprehensive or mutually exclusive, but one is called cataphatic and one is apophatic. And the cataphatic way is the way of having words and concepts and mythology and stories and images, sensory things like a lot of incense, colors. A cataphatic person would be someone whose personal meditation space has a lot of stuff. And I tend to think of the Tibetan Buddhists as more cataphatic than Zen Buddhists. The apophatic is known as the via negativa, which is the way of kenosis or self-emptying, and that is the way of not knowing and not describing and not even representing necessarily. One of the first stories in the Judeo-Christian tradition about that comes from an apophatic perspective about God is the encounter, God's first self-revelation, the encounter with Moses in the desert and the burning bush that is not consumed, and the voice that comes out of the bush that says, Moses, go and set my people free. Go and tell the Pharaoh to let go all of the slaves and tell all the people that they're now free. And he says, well, that's fine. Who shall I say sent me? And and the answer is, I am that I am. Which is this wonderful, it's not a name, it's not an explanation, it's just sort of like saying being itself sends you. And the acronym for I am that I am, the Hebrew words and therefore the Hebrew letters are transliterated as YHWH, which has been, I think, by Christians somewhat blasphemously made into a name, which was the very point of not having a name. And the name is Yahweh, by putting in vowels in between those consonants. So YHWH is simply I am that I am. So it's being itself that manifests in that pivotal story, that seminal story with Moses. And it's a very apophatic moment of not knowing and not defining. And one of the first commandments that Moses is given to share with the people is, you shall make no idols. And an idol is something that concretizes that mystery. So there have always been contemplatives in every tradition, every religion, and Judaism is no exception. And as Judaism morphed in some areas into Christianity, there were Christian contemplatives from the very start, and they became early on the desert fathers in North Egypt and elsewhere, and then eventually the monastic communities in Western Europe, the Eastern Orthodox contemplatives, many others. And as I said earlier, they've always been a minority. And half of them were put on trial for heresy because they were seen as so radical by the mainstream. And that's still the case. I mean, we don't have heresy trials so much these days, but they're still seen as radical. One of these contemplatives who was extremely influential, he lived at the turn of the 5th and 6th centuries, was a person who doesn't really have a name, strangely enough, but he's known as Pseudo, and then another person's name. And that other person's name was what he was thought to be for a while, but he isn't. So he's like Pseudo Douglas, you know, or Pseudo Tiger. And his name is Pseudo Dionysius. And Pseudo Dionysius wrote some pretty amazing stuff that was really out there at that time. He became a huge influence over people later on, like Meister Eckhart, the German contemplative and pastor, and then eventually Thomas Aquinas even was influenced by him in his thinking. And here's something I want to read to you that is sort of a prime example of the apophatic statement about God. This is what Pseudo Dionysius wrote in The Mystical Theology. There is no speaking of the supreme cause, nor name, nor knowledge of it. Darkness and light, error and truth, it is none of these. It is beyond assertion and denial. We make assertions and denials of what is next to it, but never of it. For it is both beyond every assertion, being the perfect and unique cause of all things, and by virtue of its preeminently simple and absolute nature, free of every limitation, beyond every limitation, it is also beyond every denial. So imagine what happens with people who are doing silent prayer with this understanding of God. And you get sort of a picture of what that tradition is about. There is a contemporary use of an old term that is happening these days that I'm glad is coming out in Christian circles, which is theism. And it's theism classically has been any religion that has to do with God. Like atheistic is not having to do with, or not God. And non-theistic is not having it one way or the other. But theistic was always seen as a God-centered, as a broad term. More recently, however, the term theistic has come to mean for many people, in a negative way, really, the view that God is a being. And the view that God is a being immediately separates God from everything else. And it becomes a relationship with that being. And that's where most people of faith are. They are theists in that sense, relating to a being who is God. And I believe, and these contemporary authors who are using this term now, believe that this is a kind of idolatry. It's making into a concrete thing something that is not that. One of the sources in Zen that I love in terms of speaking about this mystery in a similar way that Pseudo Dionysius does is a teacher by the name of Puan in the 12th century, and this is taken from the Thomas Cleary collection. Primordially, there is just a single energy, temporarily expressed by means of provisional terms. It contains all things, pervades all times. Beyond all natures and characterizations, it is a solitary light, the source of completeness, spiritual knowledge. From the eon of the void right up to now, it has never perished and has never been born, never increased and never decreased. So there are some things in terms of the practice and the teachings of Buddhism that, again, have been extremely helpful for me. I believe that it seems to me that there is an emphasis upon what Christians would call grace, that we are not alone in this practice. It's not the grace of what is identified as God, but it is the support of the Sangha, the support of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the support of life itself. That's the wonderful saying of Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. That's supporting us as we move along. I would call that grace, and I believe that that's a huge form of support. And as far as faith goes, my faith is that I will be supported by this, and it is good, and I'm not alone. And no matter what's going on, there is something there that supports me in my practice, in my growth, in my problems. Shinryu Suzuki wrote beautifully about this. To exist in big mind is an act of faith, which is different from the usual faith of believing in a particular idea or being. It is to believe that something is supporting us and supporting all our activities, including thinking, mind, and emotional feelings. All these things are supported by something big that has no form or color. It is impossible to know what it is, but something exists there, something that is neither material nor spiritual. Something like that always exists, and we exist in that space. That is the feeling of pure being. This is called Buddha nature or Buddha himself. This is not just theory. This is not just the teaching of Buddhism. This is the absolute necessary understanding of our life. I'm sort of running short on time. I want to make sure we have time for some discussion. But there's a tradition of emptiness and impermanence in the Christian tradition by different words. John of the Cross's famous motto was nada, 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 nothing, nothing, nothing. There's a tradition of interdependence, that we're all part of something vast. Paul called it the body of Christ. We are completely interconnected in that sense. There is the tradition of non-choosing, non-discriminating, which Buddhists will say every day is a good day. And in Christian terms, it can be a sense of surrender to what is. Many Christians would call that surrender or submitting to God's will, and Muslims too. And there's one way of thinking about that that may not be so helpful, but I think in terms of surrendering to what is as the fact of this moment or this circumstance is a tremendously liberating thing of non-choosing. And so, I spent a career translating and nudging sort of everyday Christians towards a contemplative interpretation by saying, kind of, well, this is what's often meant by this term, but let me show you a different approach here. And with some success. But it's really refreshing for me to not have to do that translating anymore. And I just like being in this tradition where the language is more direct and more clear and less burdened with the baggage that a lot of Christianity seems to carry around these kinds of terms and practices. So, let's take some time for discussion.
Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you very much, Brian. Wonderful. Very helpful. Lots of rich material. So, comments, responses? Nyozan.
I've got a bunch of them. Thank you, Brian. That was really interesting. The first one is a very sort of concrete question. It seemed in your talk at times almost as if you were using contemplative prayer and Zazen interchangeably.
Yeah.
And then later it sounded like the contemplative prayer, at least at one point, had been something that kind of inherently involved words.
No.
I was sort of wondering, now, when you sit down to do Zazen, or when you sit down to do contemplative prayer, are those two different occasions, or is it kind of one unified thing?
It's one thing, and it's really Zazen. And The thing I was referring to was that sometimes I will use words in prayer, but I have ceased to address a being as God. Oh God, please, such and such, and simply say what it is that's on my mind in that intention. In the same way that we will name things here, and that's what I meant by the use. That's really the only time I use words, other than if I go to a liturgy.
The other question I have, the question among those that I have that I choose to ask, is kind of a theological one, I guess, and I don't think it's irrelevant to I think it's a wild segue, but maybe it is. You can tell me. So there's this tradition in Buddhism expressed in the Heart Sutra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form.
Right.
That, goes on, the form is no other than emptiness, emptiness is no other than form. So that, this much bigger thing is always expressed completely and only as what we have in the material world. And at the same time, of any of these concrete things that we can put our hands on, we can say with absolute confidence, these are empty in the technical sense that,
right,
that's given in Buddhism. I was thinking about this term, theism.
Yeah.
And you used it, you defined this sort of modern sense of theism as thinking of God as a being.
Right.
And thereby separating.
Right.
Then I was thinking about the sort of Christian doctrine of incarnation.
Yeah.
That, of things of, and emptiness having to take a form, and that, right, formlessness, is there a way that those could be...
Oh, absolutely. The incarnation is emptiness manifest as form in Christ. That's the doctrine of the incarnation.
That's a bigger
doctrine than simply this person, Jesus Christ. Many theologians will see that incarnation as a principle. Mm-hmm. Mm. That we are incarnations.
But would there be room within the sort of apophatic,
yeah,
theology for a God who manifests as in some way separate?
Not separate. In fact, the first four centuries of the church were arguments, believe it or not, about the nature of Christ.
Right.
And the Council of Chalcedon put that to rest politically, and the final statement on it was this complicated thing about how the person of Christ and the Father are one and yet distinct, and it's all about not two and not one.
Yeah,
it really is.
Absolutely.
And I mean, all that language, and then it went into the Trinity as well. The Trinity was seen as three persons and one being, and it's all very complex and paradoxical, and it doesn't make sense in a logical way. And I think most Christians know that, but it's a sort of a way of talking about reality that is more than one thing at once, that is varied and yet one.
So just to add to that,
yeah,
briefly, there's a correlation. Father Tom Hand, who's a Jesuit, persuaded me of this, but there's a good correlation between the Trinity and, we've talked about this, and the three bodies of Buddha. But I would say, going back to your question, that from the Buddhist perspective, rather than whatever the ultimate or the universal, or if you want to call it God, incarnates as Jesus, just that, or as some being that in Zen, the universal incarnates as this.
Right.
Each thing.
Right. And that's what I was referring to as the broader understanding of incarnation. It's not just Jesus. It's this world, and some people even refer to the universe as God's body.
God's body.
Suchness. Yeah.
Yeah, we could talk about suchness, but let's open this up, because I'm sure all of you have comments, questions, responses. So please feel free.
I'm sidetracking a little bit. Historically,
I heard that Jesus Christ was in India for some period of his life, undergoing spiritual training through some Indian gurus or whatever. Is there some element of truth in that?
There's a lot of speculation about that and no proof of anything. What some say, which is very interesting, is that Israel, Palestine at that time was, as it has been at other times in history, a crossroads, and there were people from the East moving through there ever since Marco Polo, and there
was Alexander,
yeah, yeah. Other than that. And so there was a lot of cross fertilization of, and you look at some of the Greek philosophical people at the time of Jesus and before, starting with Alexander the Great and Hellenization, and they were influenced by Eastern ideas because they were traveling. So it's a mix, I think.
I'm sorry, influenced by Eastern. What did you say?
By Easterners, by people in India and elsewhere.
Oh, okay.
Because they were traveling.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Did you have other questions?
Oh yes, but I'm a little shy to speak them. One little germ, though, that after saying I can or will, and it may not have anything to do with what you were saying, but I had this thought that I've read somewhere that the tiniest molecule of the smallest particle of matter, everything that's in it is the smallest version of all. Is there of the universe?
That would be a fractal kind of view of a fractal view of. Well, it's just like you said, when the smallest component contains is a pattern of the all.
Okay.
In Buddhism, just. Not to get too deeply into Buddhist studies, but Huayan, one of the Chinese Buddhist schools, talks about interconnectedness in a way that, and Zen very much takes from that the sense of the connectedness of the particular, whatever size it is, and the ultimate or the universal. So there's that interaction that's very much part of Chinese Buddhist philosophy and Zen teaching.
I think it's very interesting that you find contemplative prayer and mysticism in Paul is sort of the great inspiration for Protestant thinkers.
Well, as I said, he's a complex person.
Yeah, but what I've always found resonated a lot with me, and especially in our branch of Zen, is a little bit of skepticism about spiritual experiences.
Yeah.
I think of the letter to the Corinthians where you can say, look, you're having these experiences.
Right.
I've had lots more experiences than that, and that's not what this is all about.
Exactly. Right. And really it's about love.
Yeah. And and that's something that's always resonated with me.
Yeah.
And at least in my reading of some of the mystical doctors, they're very skeptical about any concrete experience that you're going to call God. And I think that there's a lot of wisdom in that.
And some of the ones who did that more than anything were the Desert Fathers, those in the 4th century and beyond who were living in North Africa, and they're really like little Zen stories. Like there are these little Zen masters out there in the desert who, one of their favorite things to do is to kind of pull the rug out from underneath students, other monks who would thought they had something all figured out, and poof,
So we have just a little bit of time, but if anybody else has a comment or response, someone who hasn't spoken yet. Michael, yes.
I'm sorry, I'm going to try to be brief. Thanks for speaking. Your talk reminded me one thing in particular that sometimes one of the things that drew me to Zen was that there was room for me here, I thought. For a lot of times, I always just ran into doors, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes in my, what I sort of take on as my extreme openness, I actually become self-righteous, you know, and in effect, more narrow-minded.
Mm.
And so there's no, what your talk just reminded me, it just helped to sort of open it up a little bit.
Yeah, good.
You know,
good.
What openness means, or what freedom means, or what room.
Well, good.
Well, I have some sympathy for people who feel closed to Christianity because it has done so much harm, and it's hurt them personally, and that's, you know, part of the tragedy of religion.
If I may say, it isn't quite directly that, it's, but yeah, maybe on some level. But it's also just that. To have an influx of a different
good
perspective is something okay. That helps keep it immense.